and welcome to the Disability Education in Society podcast. This is a podcast for collective learning and unlearning in the struggle for intersectional liberation. We focus on educational realms, expanding to other societal areas. We share our stories as academics, as well as those of our featured guests, including disability activists involved with multifaceted dimensions of systems equity, self-determination efforts, anti-ableist, and anti-racist liberation. Join us as co-conspirators.
Hello, welcome to the Disability Education in Society podcast. For this episode, I'm going to be doing something a little different than we have done in the past on this podcast, which is to share a presentation that I recently had a chance to present this work at Purdue University. So this is right now I'm recording this at the end of April 2024, and a few weeks ago, I had the opportunity to present this presentation as well as another one, a companion presentation, if you will, to the great folks there at Purdue University who invited me to talk about some of the work I've been doing with mathematics education and disability. So this presentation is really from that visit where I had the opportunity to present this work and also have a lot of conversations with doctoral students in the mathematics education department and faculty there as well. So it was a really good visit. I really enjoyed it, and I want to share my gratitude to the folks there who made that visit possible. And for this podcast, I really also want to share some of the ideas from there so that it is more accessible to other folks besides the relatively small community there at Purdue University, which included both folks in the College of Education as well as the mathematics department. And so in this podcast, in this episode of this podcast, I'm going to share the first presentation, and I mentioned this, there's a companion presentation as well, which has more of a application component. And so you'll want to visit that once I have the opportunity to put that presentation up in the next few days. So this is the first of two presentations where I'm going to be really laying some of the groundwork for maybe what's possible in more practical sense in mathematics education classrooms. And so this, the title of the presentation, which I've adapted a little bit for this particular space, which is, the title is, What Can Special and Mathematics Education Learn from Prison Abolition Movements? And so if you are engaging with the podcast audio only, I'm actually sharing the slide deck of the presentation here. So as much as possible, I'm going to describe or read what's on the slide, in any images and tables that come up. So there are going to be some of those. If you prefer, you can go to our YouTube channel, which will have the video and the presentation. So you can have both of those engagements at the same time. So before I begin, I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the language I'm going to be using. And you probably noticed this as you've been part of this podcast, that I use a lot of disability first language, and sometimes I'll use person first language. So for example, if disability first would be like autistic person or disabled person or disabled students versus like students with disabilities. So that would be like a person first versus disability first language. And then another word on language is sometimes I use the word math instead of mathematics, and that is just really to not take up as much space. I try to keep the slides not to have too much text. I think that's generally thought of as a nice practice, not to overwhelm folks with so much text. And so by cutting the mathematics to math, I think that saves a little bit of the tat of the amount of text that's on the screen. And so in this presentation, like just to give you an overview, I'm drawing a lot on Black feminist thoughts on prison abolition and really thinking about some of the crucial tenets I think that really apply to the context that I'm talking about, which is mathematics education. And so I'm thinking a lot about the tenets of imagining utopian futures, intersectional struggles, and immediate change making. So this sort of thinking about it, the three I's. So imagining, intersectional, and immediate. And this, I think, can help guide the fields of special education and mathematics education, in particular because there is a lot of, I think, work that needs to be done there and can be done to make this idea of abolitionist practices possible. So what I do is I argue that these three tenets, the three I's, are important to eliminate the harms that disabled students encounter in special and mathematics education spaces. And while we're doing that, we're building more just futures. So I'm going to focus a lot of this presentation in elementary context, just because and I'll share the reason why that it's an important context in thinking about how current practices are a form of incarcerations that denies opportunities to certain disabled students. So in this presentation, I'm really calling on math and special education researchers and practitioners to really take up leadership in the disability freedom struggle, if you will. Okay, so I'm going to begin by talking about how I see this presentation or these ideas contributing to larger issues. So how does it contribute to conversations that's currently going on? I'm going to describe a little bit more about the three I's of abolition and education. And I'm going to spend some time examining the data on this inclusion. And so there's data out there that is gathered, that's required to be gathered by states in the United States to get a gauge of how to what extent are we practicing inclusion. And I mean this is a very rough idea, which I'll talk a little bit more about in this presentation. All right. So the work here, I feel like what I'm sharing really contributes to what many activists and scholars think about as intersectional global struggle. And so although the context is US, I think that there are a lot of connections to other forms of oppressions that happen with disability, with race, with capitalism, with settler colonialism. There are a lot of things that are related and connected. So I think the way that I see the ideas in this presentation contributes, I think, to these conversations, and really picking up on some of the thoughts by some of the folks that have come before me, such as like Angela Davis and Robin DG Kelly, as well as Patricia Hill Collins, who talks about the connected knowing and how each of the groups enriches provides a richer understanding of what we are facing here in the United States, what we many have called the belly of the beast, if you will. So a lot of the work in math education relates to how disabled students are dehumanized, and mainly because they're not seen as mathematics doers and thinkers, as powerful mathematics doers and thinkers, and consequently as seen as from a deficit point of view, which subjugates them to certain practices. And I'll talk more about how I see some of those practices are as being very parallel or similar to incarceration types of practices as well. Okay, so when I mention abolition, I mean there's so much work around abolition. I'm gonna recommend some follow-up to for us to get a better sense of abolition. I do think that Ruth Wilson Gilmore has shared some really, I think, powerful and succinct way to think about abolition in very clear ways as well. And so I'm gonna read this quote that has sort of the essence what I think about abolition, particularly for this presentation. And how we can think about this idea a little bit more in mathematics and special education contexts. So this is a quote from Ruth Wilson Gilmore, and I'm going to read it out loud here. Abolition is not absence, it is presence. What the world will become already exists in fragments and pieces, experiments and possibilities. For those who feel in their gut deep anxiety that abolition means knock it all down, scorch the earth, and start something new. Let that go. Abolition is building the future from the present in all of the ways we can. And so I think this really gets to some of the ideas that in the next presentation, I think I'm going to share some concrete ways. But in essence, I think it captures that we can do something with what we have right now. And I think that's kind of how I take up abolition in that way as well, with how Ruth Wilson Gilmore has described it. So a lot of the work that I'm going to be sharing today really comes from some of the thought leaders in this area, and in particular, I name out a few of the texts that I'm drawing from. So the first text is Abolition, period, Feminism, period, Now, and this is written by four authors: and Angela Davis, Gina Dent, Erica Miners, and Beth Ritchie. The book that came out in 2022, as well as another book that has greatly informed a lot of my thinking currently, which is Liat Ben-Moshe's book on decarcerating disability. And so what I'm taking, like the big ideas of abolition, is that there's a lot of harms of carceral logic. And we talk about, in the context of education, this sort of segregation logic that disabled folks have to be segregated or contained. So that's in abolition ways of thinking is the harmfulness. And as well as what I shared in the previous quote of from Ruth Wilson Gilmore talks about not only dismantling and also building, because alternatives to non-segregationist sort of setting is not ready made yet. So we have to build, we have to dismantle at the same time we're building something that does not yet exist. And again, the big idea here of abolition, I think that I gather from these reading is to affirm life, because as we know, life is very precarious, and Ruth Wilson Gilmore has again this very beautiful quote that talks about like life is precious, life is precious, and so it's important that we keep that in mind as well. Okay, so in this figure, I have sort of like this nested view of how I see special math education situated within sort of what we know as sites of incarceration. So prisons, we know are site of incarceration. Institutions, mental institutions. As Leah Benmosche talks about in the book, Decarcerating Disabilities. And so I'm taking the sites of incarceration within these other well better known, but in education, we maybe not talk about it. I mean, we talk about the school to prison pipeline, and some folks even talk about, well, there's no pipeline because schools are actually prisons. And so education for some, it's thought about as a site of incarceration. And in particular, in this presentation, I talk about how math and special education is part of that. They're complicit or they contribute to how incarceration is occurs in school settings, or even school within schools, if you will, or separate buildings as sort of ways of thinking about incarceration. And so I know these ideas may not be so well received in certain spaces. I know in this space, folks here will likely more, be more agreeable to this idea that yes, I agree that I see these education spaces, mathematics education spaces as a site of incarceration. But maybe others, I know others may not feel a similar sort of agreement with this. So if we think about math education as a site of incarceration, we know it starts early. Starts in kindergarten or before. I think right before this particular presentation at Purdue, I was in another space where the focus there was talking more about, and this is going to be a lot of what I'll talk about in this presentation here as well, about students who have more complex needs. So sometimes the students are referred to as having severe disabilities or profound disabilities. And in that space, it was shared that the sort of segregation of, well, you actually don't belong with other students who are non-disabled. This starts earlier than school. And so in this case, it started when this child was like 2 years old. So if you think about it, the incarceration logic, in this case, segregating folks, isolating folks to only certain spaces, begins at a very early age. And in math, I think there are many, much evidence about how we track ability, we determine math ability very early on. And so if you have a high ability, you are tracked into a higher class. And if you have gaps, so-called math learning gaps or skill gaps, then maybe you are tracking to a lower or a remedial sort of a trajectory, if you will. And we know it's very clear that once you're tracked, like the idea, right, the so-called theory is to say, well, if you're on that lower track, we're going to build your skills so that you eventually catch up to those in the higher track. But it's pretty clear for many of us that that's never going to happen, because you're not going to have the opportunities, right? The opportunities to engage with the kinds of math that will allow you to catch up. I mean, you're just doing remedial math, you're doing basic math over and over and over again. And the hope, right, and the promise is that you will eventually catch up. But again, if that tracking starts early in kindergarten, pre-K, then you are really, in a lot of ways, disabling students mathematically very early on. They're again, I have no knowledge of anyone who was tracked into a lower math class that eventually caught up to even the so-called normal track. So that's that kind of theory, if you will, if you call that a theory, is very invalid. And so it's very disturbing. It makes me angry just having this talking about it. Sites of incarceration occurs, as I mentioned, in self-contained special education classrooms, and sometimes and in the case that I know, like I've shared a lot in this podcast, that a lot of my experiences come from witnessing some of what my son has gone through. And currently, at his high school, there's a separate building for, it's called the special education building in this campus that has several buildings. So there's a special education wing of the school. And so you only disabled folks, and in the case of my son, only students who have complex needs are in that classroom. And so self-contained. And when he was younger, a lot of what he had to do to learn life skills and maybe go to other classrooms, but it was to not take part in that classroom academically or socially, but to pick up recycling material. So you can imagine in that situation, you have disabled folks come in to spaces where they're non-disabled, mostly non-disabled students, and they are the ones cleaning up, gathering recycling materials, whatever the case is. So again, I see that as a lot of sites of incarceration where students are supposed to be engaging in math, but actually, they're not thought of mathematics knowers and doers, and so maybe we. Educators in those spaces think, well, let's make better use of their time. They could learn the skill of recycling or gathering rubbish, if you will. Again, a lot of parallels I see there between self-contained special education classrooms and schools, and how mathematics education contributes to that with this idea of ability. Construction. So there are, as I mentioned, a lot of harms of that can happen here. Disablement, I talked about dehumanization. You're seeing as not capable of doing things as non-disabled students are. And loss, a lot of loss from folks who are in segregated spaces, as well as from those who maybe are not in those spaces. And here I'm talking about having the engagement, like having the opportunities to engage mathematically with folks who think differently, who experience the world differently, the ways of being, provide insights that folks get to miss out on. And so a lot of harms happen within these kinds of logics, the segregation logic and spaces that non-disabled, you get to only engage with folks who are non-disabled or who are closely resemble non-disabled. So this idea of non-disabled being the normal, and everybody should achieve that ideal. And yet folks who are further away from the norm need to be segregated so that we are not affecting negatively the rationales. Often we're negatively affecting their learning, their mathematics learning, because but the in fact, we are, because we're not providing opportunities to engage with different forms, again, of knowing and doing mathematics. Okay, so here I have a figure that kind of captures some of these things that I've, again, just been thinking a lot about, grappling with, and really this is meant to kind of think about how one of the big ideas fold into other big ideas. So the first big idea is disability studies in mathematics education, which is something that I've been doing a lot of work with others around and thinking about how we as math educators think about disabilities. And oftentimes that comes from a very ableist vantage point, again, thinking about disabilities as deficits, as not being able to do certain things. And the work that I've done before is to really push this idea of different ways of knowing and doing, such as embodiments, right? Our bodies can do or can engage in mathematics in ways that we only think, well, you can only engage in mathematics with paper and pencil or on the computer. But I think spatially, if you think about that, I mean, there is a lot of mathematics that happen. Embodiment is one of the ideas. So I've talked a lot about this idea of mathematics of instead of mathematics for. And so that's kind of some of the work with disability studies in mathematics education is that we can think about the idea that all of us are mathematical. We're born mathematical. We engage in mathematics from the time we enter this world. But there's only certain forms of mathematics that is endorsed or is thought of mathematical. And so that is a slice, if you will, of a whole field of mathematics that we could think about, that we can acknowledge, that we can affirm, that we can learn from. And yet in schools, right, we only think about certain ways and we sanction a certain way of knowing and doing mathematics. And now in this presentation, I'm folding in the ideas of abolitionist tenets. Again, the ideas of imagining intersectional immediacy, which is something that was missing from some of my earlier work with disability studies in mathematics education. So I think that abolitionist tenets has really can really help inform the math education, and particularly when we talk about the issues of disabilities. And then the third sort of idea that's folding here is Liat Bemouché's concept of this epistemologies, thinking about how disability and how I interpret Bemouché's ideas here of how ways of knowing from folks that we don't think about, again, as having ways of knowing and doing, is very or can be very informative in thinking about abolitionist practices. And so if we think about disabled folks and disabled folks of color in particular, who often have to resist narratives, have to resist being positioned as not knowing and doing, thinking about how that knowledge can inform us and should inform us. And this is, again, a tenet of disability studies, is that the voices of those most impacted should be at the center. And so I think that is something that in the next presentation, I'm going to talk more about how that could be done in sort of concrete ways, if you will. So this is that figure that I have here, and how a lot of the work here is talking about centering those who are severely or profoundly disabled in thinking about abolition. This is, again, very similar to how prison abolitionists, some prison abolitionists think about how do we abolish prisons. We can start from those who are so-called minor in criminals, you know, I'm putting quotes here. And that's in many ways, think about chipping at the edges of that work and saying, okay, start there. And this is, again, is a very similar way we think about education. It's like, oh, let's start from those who are closest to the normal. So prison dilution has sort of put that on its head in many ways, and they have thought about, like, let's start with the most dangerous few. Because if we could do that, if we can abolish prison and the prison logic for those who are most dangerous, who we consider most dangerous, then it's going to be easier to then abolish prisons for everybody. And so education, I'm thinking about it in a similar vein, in thinking about, well, who are the students that we think about as having the hardest time educating, if you will, because if we start there from the so-called severe and profound, then it's easier than to say, oh, we can do that, right? We can educate, right? We can plan for, we can think about creating awesome learning environments for this group of folks. Then that means it's easier to then do that for everybody else. However, in education, we do the opposite. We say, well, let's start from those disabilities that are closest to the normal, if you will. So folks with learning disabilities, maybe with speech impairment, those are folks, disabled folks that we may think of, well, as easier to incorporate to the normal. But that again does not change the center, if you will. The center is the normal, the non-disabled, the white, the cisgender, male, middle class, if you will. That doesn't change. That we're just trying to change everybody else to fit that center, but we have to disrupt the center. Like, the center has to be what I argue, and is very much aligned with prison abolition. That has to be the toughest ones, right? The toughest students that we could think about right now, to be part of our math learning. So that's the idea of this figure. Again, the three I's that I think are important. I talked about this idea of intersectionality in many ways. Again, this is something that was not a big part of disability studies and mathematics education when I first started working on it back in 2014, 2013, and had some articles, and my dissertation was based on that. So intersectionality, I think, is a big part of it. Talked about intersectional struggles, right? This work of disability, as I've tried to argue for here in this presentation, is related, is connected to larger justice struggles, as well as how we can learn from as mathematics educators, special educators learns from some of the struggles that have been going on. Again, not to say that they're the same. But there's a lot of mutual learning that could happen there. There's also this idea of imagining utopian future. So this is where Liat Vimoshe talks about utopian as important, and many other disability scholars have talked about, such as Alison Kafer. Like, we have to imagine, like, what the future can be, so we could start doing the work now. And so there's imagining with prison abolition world where the prisons, right, prisons do not exist. Or imagine world where prison logic is not present. And so that's important, because it means that we can do things now, like build alternatives to prisons, to segregation, no education segregation settings. Again, while we are taking these prisons or segregation spaces away, so that's imagining utopian futures as important. And then the third part is this idea of immediacy. Again, I shared a story of my son, which is like, and you know, he's pretty much out of school now, but from the time he was in kindergarten, that segregationist logic just wasn't satisfactory to me. Like, I didn't want that to happen. I wanted him to be part of the mathematics and all learning spaces as non-disabled students. But again, this is similar to this idea of prisons, right? If we talk about these sites of incarceration as sites of harm, as sites of loss, as sites of dehumanization, then we can't wait. We can't wait for that to for something to be built in its place. We have to do it now. And so this is the idea of prison abolition of Black feminist thoughts and the immediacy. That's an important aspect. And again, something that I think we as mathematics educators, special educators, can learn from.
Hi there. While we intend to make our podcast as accessible as possible, we ask those that have the financial means to support us by subscribing as a patron to our podcast for as little as $5 a month. To subscribe, go to our website, disabilityed.podbean.com. By subscribing as a patron, you will help ensure that we can continue to create and share new episodes while supporting other co-conspirators who face financial and health difficulties. For those with financial difficulties, please connect with us about obtaining a free copy of our books and/or engaging in additional conversations with us. You can also support this show by hitting the follow button, share this podcast with among your network, and leave us a comment and positive rating. Your support means so much.
And then earlier I talked about the context of elementary math as important, and the big part of that is that some of that work, some of the tracking happens early on, as well as some things that are part of elementary math that is important, that makes this work important in that particular site. Not to say that this work shouldn't happen in middle school or secondary school. I'm saying here that it's particularly important at the elementary level because, for one, that's where mathematics identity formation happens. I mean, the big example here is that's where children start thinking about themselves as, oh, I'm good at math, or I'm not good at math, or I love math, or I hate math. And so identity is really important, and it's formative during the elementary years. Children, we know, are also very curious about math, about a lot of things, including math and injustices as well. So again, this is another reason why elementary math is important. And at least the third one, I mean, there are many reasons, but I'm just sharing out three here, is that elementary schools, elementary classrooms, elementary teachers, right? I mean, there's just an ethos of inclusivity. And I don't think I've ever met somebody who have said out loud, at least out loud, that, oh, I'm not inclusive, I'm exclusive, because elementary is about belonging. A lot of what teachers try to do, administrators try to do, is to say, hey, we want to make sure children feel that they belong. I mean, that's the affective part of education is really important. And so inclusivity is something that is valued in many ways. And so I would say less so as you get on up in the elementary level, as you get into third, fourth, fifth grade, right, where testing kind of takes over, and well, I don't know about inclusivity anymore. We have other things to worry about. Again, this speaks to a larger issues we have in education, but again, this is a big part of elementary education, is that this idea of inclusivity is important as well. So that's how I'm going to, again, the companion presentation will again focus on elementary setting. I don't want to discourage others who say, well, I'm more focused in middle or secondary, because I think there are a lot of great ideas that you can glean from that presentation as well. And so I'm going to get into some of the data that we have here that gets to this idea of how are we doing with inclusivity, if you will. And again, why abolition is important to think about, because the data that we have, as you'll notice, show how well or not well we're doing. And I'm just going to say it, we're not doing well. So this is a quote from James Baldwin. And this is a quote that I just came across not too long ago, and I don't think is one that's well known of James Baldwin's quotes, many awesome quotes that James Baldwin's put out there, but I think it's fitting for this presentation. And this is a letter that James wrote to Angela Davis when Angela Davis was in jail for made up crimes, if you will. I think it was 19 in the 70s. I think that's when Angela Davis was put in jail for essentially our repressive government and FBI thinking of Angela Davis as a threat. So James Baldwin writes, "Those words, progress and democracy, now on American lips, have become a kind of universal obscenity. For this most unhappy people, strong believers in arithmetic, never expected to be confronted with the algebra of their history." All right. So in that, I'm going to then share some data. Let's look at the algebra of the history that we have in this context. And this context is the U.S. Okay. And so in the presentation, I usually like to ask folks, like, what do we think about the inclusion, how well we're including disabled youth in our classrooms, and this is data we have of disabled students ages K to 12 as included in general education classrooms. Okay, so I asked that question, and those engaging the podcast, you can guess, and I'm not going to follow up and check on your guesses, but just kind of think about what percentage of K-12 disabled students are included. And this is from data that is gathered from the U.S. Department of Education. It's required, it's mandated, federal data that states have to collect. So we have that data, and we have that data for many years. And so take a guess. And in this graphic here that I have the years from 1989 to 2021. That's our most recent data that we have. And the graph is the percentage of disabled students ages 6 to 21 spending 80% or more of their school day in general education classrooms. So this is really the 80% or more of their, like, if think about a student in a school, and they're spending 80% of their school day in a general education class. And that could be in math, that could be in language arts, it could be social studies, science, lunch sometimes, arts, PE. I mean, those are all considered general education spaces, which, again, as a side question here, like, who are general education spaces for? That's something to think about. Clearly, they're not for everybody, even though it's general. So that's a problem itself. So in the graph here, and I'll again describe it verbally, is that from 1989 to about 1994, we have a big spike in the percentage of children who are spending the 80% or more, let's say, a significant portion of the day in general education spaces. So it's in the low 30s to around 45% of disabled students. So there's a big jump from 1989 to 1994. And then from 1994 to 2021 is more of a, in mathematics, we call it a logarithmic function. So it's sort of in many ways plateaus. Again, this is how I'm reading it. And others may kind of have other interpretation of it. So exponentially from 1989 to 1994, but more logarithmically from 2000, from 1995 or maybe even like 2003 on to the present day. And so when I was at Purdue, someone said, "What about in math?" Well, I don't think we have that data in math education. And in the person that asked the question said, "Well, I think it's going to be lower for math." So our current inclusion rate, if you will, is about 66.5. So it's again some progress, but in many ways it's flattening out. So in math education, I think we can mostly agree that it's going to be lower because math is one of the most exclusionary, or if not the most exclusionary, content area. And so again, we talk about ability tracking. And so how likely is a disabled youth who is not thought of as a mathematics knower and doer going to be included in a mathematics classroom, a general education classroom? And so these numbers are an aggregate, means that we collect all this data from all 50 states in the US, we put it together and we spit out a number. So 66.5 right now, as of 2021, of disabled youth are spending a big portion of their day in the general education classroom, considered inclusion. And again, a lot of questions we can ask here. One is like, is it inclusion if you're just in that space? And we know again from the literature is that even if you are included, that there, you could still be very much excluded in inclusive spaces or general education spaces. So I guess I shouldn't say inclusive because even general education spaces are not guaranteed to be inclusive. But the data says that you are in that space. And so some might think of this data as being included. So this is a graph I put together because I think all the graph I've found that are out there on the web are really showing like maybe 10-year periods. And so I was able to gather or track down the data from 1989. There's some years missing just because I think the data had missing years there, but I was able to put this together in this like a 30-year period of the data that we have available, and I've displayed it here. Now, the next graphic shows a little more in detail some of the differences among different disability categories. So I mentioned the 66.5. Now that is going to be varied based on the disability. Again, we have the data, and it's we have a lot of numbers and a lot of data here. And again, I put this in a graphic, and I'll describe this graphic to you, which has the 13 disability categories. It's a bar graph with 13 disability categories. On the horizontal axis and on the vertical axis, it has the percentage within each category that fits within the different thresholds of inclusion. So I talked about the 80% or more as being considered inclusion, There's another band, which is between 40 and 79%. There's a third band, which is less than 40%. And then there are other bands. And the one that I included here are like separate schools or homeschool and so forth. But the big idea in this particular figure is that your inclusion, disabled youth inclusion is really dependent on their disability to a big extent. So the disabilities that have the highest number of inclusion are learning disabilities around 75.1, speech language impairment 88.3, and so again, those are above the 66.5 that I've drawn a red line here, demarking. I'm not sure I used the right word there. How it's different. Like, so you have disabilities who are above the 66.5, which again will drive that average across all 13 disabilities, and then you have disabilities that are going to be a lot lower than the 66.5. And so one of them is intellectual disabilities, which comes in at 20.1, or multiple disabilities at 15.5, emotional disturbances 55.1, and autism 40.8. So those are a lot lower. And in the next slide, I'll show you how that intersects with race. And so most white youth are categorized or put in the category of learning disabilities. Again, that one, the highest inclusion rates, if you will, speech language impairment, while those students of color are more likely to be placed in the other categories that are less likely to be included, or with the lower race that I shared. And then I'll also point out some of the separate school numbers, which again tends to be higher for certain disabilities, lower for other disabilities. So you have deaf blindness as a disability that tends to be is the highest disability that tends to have separate schooling, multiple disabilities, intellectual disabilities, emotional disturbances. So separate school is another placement option. And Leah Bemoshi talks about this least restrictive environment, which many other scholars have talked about. That's a problem, because it gives schools an option to say, well, this student's least restrictive environment is a separate school. This student's least environment is a separate classroom. And so if you have that option, as many critics will say, then students are going to be placed there. So the idea is that, as with prison abolition, like if we don't have those options, right? If we don't have the options of segregating students, then inclusion is the default, and the continuum of services, or the least restrictive environment. If you don't have the options, then we have to do what we have to do. And again, it's not an easy task. It's not something that we have in place, but it's an abolitionist way of thinking about what the data is here, which is to say, well, different disabilities are going to be placed differently, right? Based on your disability, based on your race, right? And so it's important, again, to think about why abolitionists ways of knowing and doing and thinking of things, and approaches to dismantling current practices is important. All right. So here's the disproportionality data, which comes from the Office of Special Education. And I'm just going to read these because I kind of shared them already in the previous slide. So first, Asian disabled students more likely to be labeled with autism or hearing impairment. Again, you could think about the stereotypes of Asians and how and why, right? Those disability categories tend to happen to that group of students. Black disabled students more likely to be labeled as intellectually disabled or emotionally having emotional disturbance. Again, who's determining these disabilities, and how are they determining? These are questions. Latinx disabled students are more likely to be labeled as hearing impaired, intellectually disabled, or having specific learning disability. And then the last one I mentioned, white disabled students are more likely to be served inside a regular classroom 80% more of the day. Again, this parallels a lot with some of the bigger systemic things that happen here in the United States with the Supreme Court decision of Brown versus the Board of Education, which ruled that separate schools for blacks and whites is not equal. And so there was a big effort in the United States to integrate schools, but there was a lot of resistance as well. And so scholars here have talked about how special education has been used as a tool to continue segregate blacks and whites. And so the data bears this out here in that way. Okay, in this next screen, then I talk a lot about math specifically, and this is based on some of the research that Rachel Lambert and I have done, which again, look, in math education, who are we focused on? Which disability we tend not to be focused on. And so first, like in math education, we actually don't focus a lot on disabilities, or we don't name it out, at least. And maybe participants who are part of a research has a disability, but they're not named as having a disability. But when we do have that information, we could see here in the slide that most of the research focuses on learning disabilities. Again, you can go back to the previous slides and who are the folks who have or more likely to be identified as having a learning disability. And also the way I view it in this case is how close to the normal are you? Again, the normal as the white, male, cisgender, middle class person, right? And so the closer you are, like in research mathematics, we say, well, let's focus on those who are closest. And less so, right? The data here also bears this out, less so on those who may have more complex needs or intersectionally are of a different race, such as having emotional disabilities. And so again, you could see in the graph here, I've kind of shown some of the outcomes of that work from Rachel Lambert and I, and so learning disabilities is the most at about 28%, and then within that learning disability, there's this particular disability which is named dyscalculia. That's a topic for another day. Math difficulties, it's also subsumed within that learning disabilities. But then the next category, if you will, is intellectual disability, which is a much lower percentage from the 28 that we have to 7% of the articles that we looked at focuses on intellectual disability, autism. pretty much around that and emotional disabilities, as I mentioned. And so, again, the distribution of disability, again, tends, I would say, tend to focus a lot on those who are closest to the center, closest to being so-called normal. And so, again, this is how mathematics education research, I would say, is complicit and perpetuates these ideas. And again, I know that the what I'm saying here is not very popular, but I don't mind speaking my truth. Okay, so just some ways that, again, with the three I's, that I see math education and again, special education here. When I say special education, I know there are a lot of special educators who are doing some awesome work who are with this idea as well, and not all special education and not all math education either. But is this is a call to think about the I's, the three I's of prison abolition, to think about how we can go from co-signing disablement, again, how these segregated spaces are disabling, to dreaming radical futures. And so this is really, I draw this a lot from Robin D.G. Kelly, in to do that with those most marginalized. And this is important because we could think about, oh, this is my radical dream as, again, as a for me, like an Asian American male, non-disabled person, I could have these dreams, but that those dreams are not, the dreams may not be the same dreams as those who are most marginalized. So it's important to do that and to really center the voices of those marginalized, because they are the ones with, you know, Lee Abed-McShay talks about this epistemologies, right? They have a certain way they've experienced being dehumanized, being placed in these segregated spaces. So they know what's possible. They know better than we who think about these incarceration logics as what is natural, which is not. It's something that we've created. Which means that, again, we can do something different, but it's important to do it with those who are most marginalized. All right, another I, intersectional justice struggles. And so for math and special educators, going from being the agents of carceral state, this is a quote from Erica Bullock and Erica Minor, have talked about. We have to think about ways, right? We have to recognize how we have uphold systems of oppression, and our role as math educators, as special educators, in perpetuating ableism, racism, and other oppressions. So thinking about being a leader in this, I would say, abolitionist work. And immediate. And again, this is something that we could do things here and now, right? We don't have to wait until systems are in place or somebody else does this, or yeah. I mean, there's a lot of important work that could be done, and immediate is important. And also recognizing, and this goes back to the text, Abolition Feminism Now, we talk about immediacy as also being patient. I mean, this is sort of the teaching. We want to do something, right? We want to reduce the harm, and know sometimes that this work may be challenging, or not may, is challenging. And then it's going to require experimentation, and that we don't actually know what we're doing, and that's okay. Because it's part of abolitionist work. Like, we don't have the answers right in front of us. We don't have prescriptions. There's many ways to do abolitionist work. It's going to be different with different people in different contexts. And so it's important and to, and again to resist this comfort that okay, here are the steps that we can take to do abolitionist work, because in many who do abolitionist works would say that those don't exist. It's more about how we work in solidarity with one another. We care for one another, and we do the work, as Ruth Wilson Gilmore talks about, with what we have here and now. And then the important part here is, where do we start? And I think I, for me and for other prison abolitionists, we want to think about who is at the center. Who do we start from? And the ideas from the dangerous few, as Liat Ben-Moshe in reference to Feyyahni Naab, who has done a lot of work with prison abolition, and talks about this idea of starting from those who are the most challenging, and that we think about. We need prison because of these few. Similarly, in education, we need secure spaces because of these this small group of students, very complex needs, who have severe and profound disabilities. And so if we start there, then it makes the work of in the work of including, right, much easier. And so the graph that I showed, the logarithmic function, if you will, of sort of like we've been stagnating with our inclusion, no matter what we think about the quality of inclusion, that no matter what, I mean, that number has stagnated. And if we keep chipping on the edges, like, oh, let's get those who are closest to the normal in those spaces, we are not going to get to those who are most marginalized anytime soon, if ever. And so we need to, in my view, recenter. Like, let's start by getting students in general education classrooms who are the most difficult, who have severe and profound disabilities. We start there. That means we'll have an easier time including other folks. Now, as we talked about inclusion into those spaces that are problematic to begin, is a problem. So we're not just including students or integrating students to existing spaces that are problematic. So again, this parallels the words of Martin Luther King, who talks about, I'm afraid I've integrated my people into a burning house. So we know it's the general education classroom is problematic in many ways. So this abolitionist work is about, it's very much in line with radical inclusionists who talk about, it's not only about integrating, but it's all changing that what exists already. So it's transforming those into spaces that is reciprocally caring, the spaces that honors, affirms life, affirms different ways of knowing, affirms different ways of being in this world, which is not, our general education spaces are not that. And so it's important to think about when we start from those who are severe and profound, it also provides an opportunity to think about, to rethink about those general education spaces as well. All right, so this was a rather lengthy presentation. I could feel it in my voice, probably. Feel it on your end as well. I've spoken at length here. I just want to capture this image that I shared earlier about how these ideas coalesce in ways that build on disability studies and mathematics education, which really shifts the focus on deficits from the individual to the system, right? Thinking about system as curriculum, the fixing the curriculum, fixing pedagogy, fixing the ways we relate to one another, thinking about mathematics as having multiple ways of knowing and doing, and then folding in within that some of the ideas of prison abolition, the three I's that I've shared today, imagining intersectionality and immediacy, and then the third aspect is this epistemologies, this term that Liat Ben-Moshe talked about. Where do we start this work? And we start from those who are most marginalized. And so if we start there, this makes this work of abolition more possible, into a utopian future, that we can create. All right. And so I mentioned this quote a little earlier, and I'm going to close this presentation with the quotes from Ruth Wilson Gilmore, who talks about what are we, I mean, this presentation, I think, is really about life and how life is precious, and repeats its life is precious, because it is. And prison abolition is at the heart about life, I think, about how we value certain lives, we devalue other lives, and we have to think along the lines that all of our lives are very precious, and we have to do something about it. We can't continue to witness, contribute, and take part in the work, that perpetuates these kind of logics that are carceral. So thank you so much. As I mentioned, I am going to be sharing this the companion presentation, which will take on these ideas into the classroom. So what can this look like? Again, it's an abolitionist practice. This is one way of many possibilities. In mathematics, maybe we talk about permutations that is possible to take on. And so stay tuned for the next episode where I will talk about, and share some ideas that I've done in the work that I do with teachers, elementary teachers, the idea of abolitions and what can that look like? And so to the question that I posed earlier, what can special mathematics education learn from prison abolitionist work? The short answer is a whole blank lot. All right. Take care, buddy.
Thank you so much for engaging with the DES podcast. We post new episodes every few weeks. The DES podcast is made possible and sustainable in solidarity with you and those who generously volunteer their time to converse with us. We hope you join us on our next episode.